Hey everyone, and welcome to this, a Risky Business feature interview podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. You'll notice that from here on out, I'll often be publishing feature interviews outside of the regular weekly show. That means I can run them longer and I can allow a bit more room for news. And honestly, it'll make my production schedule a little bit less hectic just for those major production days as well. This feature interview is brought to you by our most recent weekly show sponsor, Trail of Bits. Do check out our sponsor interview with them in the most recent weekly news edition. And yeah, you're going to hear an interview I did something like a month ago with Bob Lord, the Chief Security Officer for the Democratic National Committee, the DNC. Bob has previously served as the CISO for both Yahoo and Twitter before spending some time in vendor land with Rapid7 as their CISO in residence. Now, it goes without saying that the state-sponsored attack against the DNC is, without doubt, the most politically consequential data theft event this planet has ever witnessed. It trumped both the Chelsea Manning WikiLeaks disclosures and ClimateGate in terms of impact, and indeed, to a large degree, the fallout of the DNC hack is still ongoing. So I wanted to bring Bob in just to talk about his job, really. Now, the DNC isn't a large organization in a head office sense. They have about 200 core staff members. But as you'll hear, political organizations, their IT setup is pretty atypical. So Bob and I, really just mostly spoke about what you do as a CISO for an organization like that. You'll also note he's been in the news over the last few days because a phishing attempt directed, or a phishing campaign directed at the DNC, turned out to be an unauthorized security test, as far as I can tell, by someone well-meaning. Now, funnily enough, you'll hear that this sort of thing has actually happened before to the DNC. So I started off by asking Bob where he began when he took on the job of CISO for the DNC, and here's what he had to say.
Normally, and I've done this with other jobs, I just go and talk to people and listen. I think a lot of it is just assuming that I really don't know anything. And I think that was especially easy coming into this environment because the political space is really just, it is just different. Mm. I spent a lot of time talking with Tom Perez, who's the chairman, talked with obviously Rafi, who's been here for a number of months, Rafi Kerkorian, who's the CTO, talked to him for a while. And then really just got to know a bunch of different people in a lot of different organizations. I would still say I'm going to be the noob in the world of politics for quite some time. The way that organizations get built, the way that we have, relationships with the different state parties, campaigns, it's all very nuanced. And there's a lot of, in the same way that we have a lot of jargon, they have a lot of jargon. And I've got to pick up on that. So really, that was the main thing I had to do. And sometimes you'd be surprised. You just ask people, where do you think the biggest problems are? And they're often correct. People's spider sense is often very, very accurate.
Mm. When we look at an organization like the DNC, I mean, it's volunteer heavy. It's massively distributed. I'd imagine, well, I don't know, but I'd imagine that the budgets for IT, budgets for everything in political parties, at least here in Australia, are usually pretty stretched, right? I mean, the lay of the land, as you say, the political landscape is different. But is that a fair characterization of the DNC as just being this sort of stretched, massive, distributed, underfunded sort of organization?
Sort of. So I'll give you my current impressions. And of course, I'll look back at this a year from now and say, what a child I was for such a juvenile explanation of these things. But so the DNC is an organization. So that's the national party. There are, I believe, 57 state parties. So there's, District of Columbia and American Samoa and Guam and a number of others. So those entities are separate. They're related, but they're separate legal entities. They have their own staffing guidelines. They have their own way of conducting their business. And that makes a ton of sense, since what we're really trying to do is try to get activities driven out and decisions made in the field. And so it makes a ton of sense for those organizations to be independent. Now, those are also different from, but related to the campaigns. And so while the DNC and the state parties are consistent organizations year after year, campaign season after campaign season, we also have these what Rafi calls pop-ups, which are the campaigns. And they start up one day, they hire a bunch of people, they do some work, but their exit strategy is after the election, you go do something else. Maybe you've won the office, maybe you haven't. But either way, you go do something different. So the cadence and the emphasis and the incentives for each of these organizations is really just different. So the state parties don't work for me. The DNC itself is under 200 people. So it's on the order of the same size as when I joined Twitter. So still pretty small, more like a mid-sized startup. And so the challenge is really to figure out how to listen to various people in various state parties and the campaigns, try to understand what their constraints are. Again, different staffing constraints, budgets, technical knowledge. You go down the line, they're just all different. And so what we've been trying to do is really listen to them as well. So I've got that inner focus of being hired by the DNC to help protect the DNC and help them get better. But the charter also encompasses helping these other folks do the things that they need to do.
I'd imagine these state branches, right? They'd be, it's almost like you're going to be operating a franchise model, right? Like, I mean, that sort of seems like that's the immediate analogy that pops into my head is you've got your central office and then your franchisees.
Yeah. But in franchises, there's often a series of rule books that they must follow. You know, what's actually important and this works in the aggregate very well, which is getting the decisions made in the area, out in the field. That kind of works against me. So to the extent that I have a charter that has the state parties as well as the campaigns in scope.
Yeah, so you can't force them to do anything, right? You can just suggest and provide tools and hope that they use them.
Absolutely. And so one of the things that I think you mentioned, I think it was 2 weeks ago, was this checklist. And so one of the things is I started to create this list of things that people should do. And I started noticing, I shopped it around and it turns out everybody has a list of things that people should do. And they're all roughly the same. Good news is they're all roughly the same. So, at least there's not tremendous conflict within the security community around these things. But the observation was people really aren't doing this. And the thing that occurred to me was that we probably needed to make it very actionable rather than just a series of suggestions. And so the checklist that I think you mentioned is meant to be printed out and it's meant to be actually run through by individuals, hopefully in teams so they can support each other. In many cases, there's no IT person in the state parties or in the campaigns. And so they really have to look out for one another. And we've been starting to get a fair amount of good feedback around that. But again, that's partly because I'm new and I have this title and I have the ability to go to people fresh, but it's also partly because I've been reaching out to individuals and the tech folks. There's another part of the ecosystem I should mention, and that is that there are many, many other organizations that are working to help the state parties and the campaigns. There's one in particular that really caught my eye, and it's called the DigiDems. So it's the Digital Democrats. And they are, this is a small company, and their goal is to take 80 tech-savvy individuals and embed them in important campaigns. And so they've had two training sessions so far. There's another one coming up. And so I went there as part of the security training. And for me, this is important because I don't have people in the field in each of these state parties. I don't have people in the campaigns. But if they're going to be embedded, it was really an opportunity for me to try to influence them, sort of a, I guess you'd call it train the trainer model.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, so we went out and been working with them to train them, be part of their ecosystem. And the other thing that allows me to do is to get some telemetry back from the field. So yeah, I'm well aware that if I said, hey, I'm Bob, I'm from headquarters, please send me important information about security matters that come to your attention, that some people will find that resonates with them and they'll do that. But I think a lot of other people wouldn't necessarily think that was important. So having the DigiDems go out and provide some additional telemetry has proved very, very interesting. And so getting a little bit of the hard reality of what's happening in the field, that's been very useful. And that's also
kickstarted. So look, we've got the lay of the land now, right? So I'd imagine like the list is, I'm guessing something that's been a pretty critical initiative. And I'm guessing the things on it are going to be things like either role 2FA or, into Google Advanced Protection if you're a Gmail user. Patch all of your shit, like all of that regular advice. I mean, I guess that's the baseline stuff. So I'm guessing that's what's on your list, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's literally, here's how you secure your devices. Here's how you secure your accounts, 2FA, password managers, update your software. It's all very, very basic, but it's all very actionable. So it specifically calls out You know, did you update Twitter? Did you update your Facebook? Did you update your personal Facebook? And so what I'm trying to do is get to the point where we don't see defacements of campaign Facebook pages and things along those lines. This is, it's on the one hand very easy, and yet, as you've noted on the show before, just getting people to do it is a real struggle.
Well, yeah. And look, we had a listener question, which I thought was a good one, because before I jumped on this call, I asked listeners, do you have any questions? And one of them was, you know, considering what happened in 2016, have you found that you've got amazing buy-in from the organization and from the people in it because of what's happened, that they're much more sort of likely to do what you want? Because I would have thought they'd be like, security guy, to just tell us what to do.
Yeah, sort of. You know, humans are very interesting. And the thing that I was most afraid of when I got here was that people would be sensitized, but not sensitized in a way that would cause them to change their behavior and their habits. So, you know, when I've looked into other things that are sort of related to security and how people react to trauma, I found some very disconcerting things. So, for example, you know, people who have a heart attack and are carted away in an ambulance, at least in America, the things that they're told to do include just what you think. You need to change your diet. You need to exercise. And if you're under 50 and you've had a heart attack, you're a smoker, so you need to stop smoking. And, you know, what percentage of people do you think actually do all three?
Mm.
Right. The answer, it's actually women do much more than men. But the average comes out to something like 4%
that
do all three.
Okay. So that's even lower than I expected.
Yeah. So
the wake up call is not necessarily effective in all instances.
I think that's exactly right. So, and the same thing with, you know, people who have had a flood, they live in a flood zone, they have had a flood. And so you think that they would immediately rush out and buy insurance and that they would keep paying for flood insurance every year. It turns out they do it the first year and then they stop doing it after a few years because there hasn't been a flood. So there are lots of examples of people having a major trauma and then not taking appropriate long-term action. So this is what I'm up against. This is what all security professionals are up against, and probably one of the sources of a lot of the, I don't know, the anxiety and the nihilism that you see in some security people. I think it's tied to this. So that was one of my concerns, is are people scared but not actually willing to change behavior? So a lot of what I work on is managing that behavior. So a few data points. One is, when we started to measure things, I won't go into too many details, but measure certain things on the network and compliance against certain best practices, I got people's attention right away and people started falling in line. So
that was the holy God moment.
So like doing some of those things turned out to be relatively straightforward.
Can't go into specifics, but give us an indication of how bad was it. I mean, was it that situation? And I'm guessing, look, a small organization, you're talking head office, 200 people, you know, I'm guessing they weren't big spenders on security. And I'm guessing they just, you know, like any other organization of the same size, they just do things in order to get them done, not necessarily thinking about security. You know, you get someone who's got a bit of history with InfoSec, they go in, they have a look at a network like that. It's usually a horror show. I mean, I don't think it's, as I say, I'm not asking for specifics, but was it a horror show?
The organization had good people doing good work. But until you hire somebody whose job it is to focus on security and take that adversarial view of things, it's tough. And so I think a lot of things have started to fall into line there. One other indication I think that was very useful.
That was a nice sidestep, by the way. You've obviously been spending time with politicians, because that was artfully done, Bob.
Thank you, sir. That's coming from you. That's a high compliment. One of the things that I really wanted to do is make sure that we were working towards planning for the next breach. And so to that end, I wanted to have an executive tabletop exercise. And it's surprising how many senior people at companies just have not been through a tabletop exercise. And so we were able to do that. And, you know, when I explained it to Tom Perez, what it was and why I needed to do it, he immediately jumped on board. He immediately understood that, you know, Bob showing up doesn't mean that all security problems go away, that we need to plan for the inevitable next thing. And so we had a half day run through of a fairly serious kind of thing. And we throw a lot of curveballs at folks. And I'm just thinking about it out loud now. We should probably throw you into the mix for the next one as part of the scenario. You know, get a call from Risky Business.
Yeah. Hey, I got an email from this guy.
So yeah, a lot of my concern, I had a lot of anxiety. Like, would Tom Perez really show up? Would he actually force all of the folks and his senior staff to show up? And he did, and they all showed up, and it went reasonably well, considering that the folks who were here really weren't through the, they weren't here in the 2016 breach. They did remarkably well. And so we're going to make that part of a recurring pattern. And so we're, you know, I think that's another indication that they're willing to learn to take direction and to turn that PTSD into effective behavior change.
Yeah. Now, look, one thing that people seem fixated on, to be honest, is this idea of, oh, everyone needs to use 2FA. And look, 2FA is great, right? And I think people are fixating on that because a lot of the reporting around, you know, Russian activity in 2016 was on the Podesta email fish, right? And of course, there was that OPSEC screw up where we saw the Bitly, you know, all of the Bitly links for all of their targets and realized that they'd been spearfishing an awful lot of people. So, you know, there's this huge focus on, wow, 2FA would have stopped so much of this. But really, when we look at the 2016 DNC intrusion, it was a malware-based intrusion into the network. It had nothing to do with 2FA. Have you noticed that there's that fixation among the public when talking about all things DNC security? There is a real fixation on 2FA, like, oh, just put 2FA on everything, and they seem to think that that will somehow solve the problem?
Yeah, it's a good question. Are you also referring to, I think Shane Huntley had done a tweet about this recently saying, you know, again, 2FA is a partial solution and it's going to help, but the more advanced adversaries can not only ask for your name and password, but for your name and password and six-digit PIN.
Well, but I mean, you know, if you're using a YubiKey, for example, that's null and void. But I mean, it, you know, just because you're using 2FA doesn't mean you can't wind up receiving, malware through your perfectly authenticated email, right? Like, that's more my point.
Yeah, and so I think we've also seen things where it's the all but for. So Equifax would have been safe, but for the, the Struts vulnerability. So, yeah. And that's just,
yeah,
not
people
how
act like, oh, if they had a patch that, like, the attackers would have just gone away. It's like, no, they probably would have used some sort of different bug because that organization was heaving with technical debt, right?
Yeah, so, you know, the water in a cracked vase doesn't have to be told how to get out. It's going to find its way out. If it doesn't find its way out this way, it's going to find its way out the other way. So that's absolutely right. So what I tell people on a regular basis, it sounds so obvious, but I think we often forget it. And most executives don't actually internalize this, which is that we're up against dedicated human adversaries who work in campaigns. And when I talk to people about this, I drain those words. So I talk about what dedicated means. You know, they show up in fatigues, they show up in flip-flops. That's what they do, and they're human. So every time we make an improvement, they get to decide what to do about it.
That's the whole thing of, right, operational sophistication trumping technical sophistication every time.
Absolutely. And they work in campaigns. So, you know, for example, the accounts that were compromised at Yahoo, I don't know what they were actually looking for, but I can guess they were looking for address books. Maybe they were looking for what kind of phone that person had. Maybe they wanted to use that to deliver malware. But those campaigns extend far beyond the reach of any one particular attack. It's much broader than that. So I think we sometimes forget this and think that whatever the path was the only path that the attackers could have taken. And that's simply not true.
Well, so we've already established that you've gone out there and, you know, you're distributing guides that people can use to sort of better secure their devices, right? And that's great. So, you know, 2FA patching, all of the basic advice, right? So but the thing is, I mean, you know, clearly your adversaries are of the more exotic kind. And that is the curliest problem in InfoSec, dealing with a dedicated, well-resourced adversary. You know, no one really has a solution to that problem, right? So the question is on the network side, and just in a general sense, how are you tackling this in a different way to a regular organization's security when, you know, I mean, you're not a mid-sized credit union worrying about financially motivated hackers. You know, you're dealing with some very sophisticated attackers. So it's going to require some out of the box thinking. So what's your magic here?
Well, we're going to see what the magic is. But again, I think we sometimes get distracted, and when we start to invoke the demons of the nation state adversary, I see people starting to say things like, oh, well, then it's hopeless, so we shouldn't really do much of anything. And they don't quite put it in those terms, but they're sort of on that end of the spectrum.
If they want to get you, they'll get you. Yeah, which isn't necessarily true, especially when you're dealing with a small enough organization. And if you're talking 200 people, right, I can see that it's doable. I just want to know how you're doing it.
Yeah. So again, I think there's that nihilism part that comes in when you start to invoke the nation state demons. And then other people get so fixated on advanced machine learning and AI and threat intel. And, you know, I just feel like if you're not doing the work to crawl and then walk and then run, you're really going to find yourself in a bizarre situation. So I don't know that there's any particular magic. I'll tell you, like, some of the projects that we're working on include the incredibly glamorous work of identity and access management. It's incredibly glamorous to worry about onboarding and offboarding and changes and privileges.
It's about doing the basics, but doing them perhaps more thoroughly than the next organization.
More thoroughly, but also I think a lot of what I try to do is not worry as much about the technology, but also to think about the people in the process. So one of the things that we did at Twitter was when we were rethinking the identity and access management system is we had a system in which HR would request, they'd open up a ticket request that the IT team would create an account, and then IT would create the account because they were privileged to create the account, and then they would send a ticket back to HR saying, okay, go ahead and use this web tool to populate it with data and assign people to various groups. And this is just a broken process. And so we could have improved the efficiency of that broken process, but we decided to really think through who should be privileged to create accounts in the organization, who is trained to know how to push back on various people. So if the CEO shows up and says, here's my ghostwriter, please give him an account, it's more like HR is going to push back, not IT. And so we did things like stripping the help desk of the ability to modify accounts, to add and delete accounts, and fully empowered the HR people to do that and really explain to them that they're in charge of network security in a very real way. And that if there are people who are not properly offboarded, it's going to cause an increase in risk.
Well, speaking of onboarding and offboarding, you know, you're a volunteer heavy organization with campaigns spinning up and spinning down. There's people coming and going. I mean, yeah. I'm guessing that takes up a few of your hours every week, right?
Yeah. So that's part of it. So we have the people who are here, and so we need to make sure that the processes here continue to improve and that they're rigorous. But as you say, there are all sorts of people who are, they're volunteers, they're working in various states. And so the people who are doing data analytics, they need to do that for their particular state or their particular county. So of course we need to keep track of those too. And so like a lot of organizations, we need to understand how do we build the right processes so that we're doing the right thing and we're enabling people to do what they need to do. But the technology needs to follow a properly designed process. So we're going to be reinventing a few of these things over time. Again, not glamorous, no AI, no magical pixie dust with threat intel for those kinds of things. Just some of the basics around making sure that you know what are your assets, who are your people, how are you going to protect them. Really, just the boring basics in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. And in terms of, I mean, you know, you've mentioned threat intel is not, not so hot with you at the moment, right? And I can totally understand that. And you're not buying into a lot of the hype around the current generation of ML tools. I mean, what's your approach to monitoring and detection? I guess that's the sort of thing that maybe you don't want to talk about on a podcast though, right?
There are definitely things I don't want to talk about right now. I do feel like there are a number of things that we as a community should be sharing a little bit more boldly. And so I'd like at some point after the election to talk about some of the things that we've done, some of the things that have worked, but also some of the things that haven't. I'll have to figure out what the right vehicle for that is. But we're in an interesting situation where we are not Yahoo or Google or Facebook. We don't have 150 security people here. We're under 200 people total. So and yet the value of the information that we have is great, but this is the same as a lot of different organizations. Very few organizations can really survive having all of their data dumped out in public. It's a very difficult thing. So I think there are some interesting things that we may be able to share with other smaller organizations about how to spend time cutting services. One of the things I've been doing is taking a look at some of the services we have in house and just cutting them, just saying like, we don't need two of these. We just need one. and then working to shut systems down. So I think there's some things that we can share in terms of the approach and also in terms of the technology that we've used.
Now, it would be remiss of me, Bob, not to ask you for some sort of reaction to the indictment that landed a couple of weeks ago. I mean, I know that this indictment covers alleged activity that predates your involvement with the DNC, but, you know, do you have any comment on it whatsoever?
Yeah, one of the interesting things, and I found myself in the situation on a surprisingly regular basis, is you know, whenever there's active either law enforcement or other sort of legal action in play, there are some guardrails that get set up that are as frustrating for me as it is for other people to hear. There's not a lot I can talk about with regard to the indictment in particular. I mean, I will say that these are very bizarre times, and it is surprising how many places the administration is falling short in terms of helping us. So, you know,
I really did wonder why, given the circumstances, there hasn't been more of a response from the US government. And particularly, I mean, the NSA has a mission to protect, you know, American interests. I would have thought one of the major political parties would be, you know, would qualify. And yet we haven't really seen much. And I don't just mean for the Democrats. I mean for the GOP as well, because, you know, protecting your two major political parties from external interference seems like a pretty good idea. It's surprising, right?
Yeah, taking even just the parties out of it, there, you know, the administration doesn't seem willing to fund things like extra money for security for the free and fair elections. That's a genuinely surprising thing. We would have expected to see more sanctions on Russia now that we know more than we have before, but that's not the direction we're going. And you know, you've talked about power grids being vulnerable before, and now we're reading more articles about that. And you know, the one thing I would say about the indictment that's kind of interesting, and it's, I think you and your listeners would have already have understood this, but I think it's now very well understood that we're not just talking about, what is it, the proverbial hacker sitting on his bed that weighs 400 pounds, but this was actually a concerted intelligence operation. And that should be very disconcerting to people now that we have their names in public.
Now, look, of course, you know, another thing that I absolutely have to ask about is what sort of activity you're seeing, what sort of attacker activity you're seeing. I mean, are you living in a constant state of batting away, pretty persistent attempts?
So there's a little bit of that. It's hard to say right now. I'm very glad that we're starting to get telemetry from the states and from the campaigns. One of the things that we're starting to see, and I can't go into too much detail at this point, but we're starting to see things that are kind of on the edge of digital and human activity. And so it's hard to know exactly what some of this activity is, but it's a little concerning. And
are you talking about volunteer accounts getting a little bit too curious on the network, things like that?
Well, like I said, I can't go into too much detail. But
that's it.
It's, you know, in part because two reasons. One is I don't want people who, if they're actually are, if they're engaging in activities, I don't want them to know exactly what I know. And then I also don't want people to start to get any clever ideas about things. So at some point, I'll talk about this more. But yeah, there's some things happening, and that's to be expected. I expect that will increase between now and the election. I expect the few weeks before the election to be very volatile, but it's hard to say at this point.
Yeah, right. So at the moment, it's battening down the hatches, keeping an eye on some stuff that might be suspect, and just sort of getting ready.
We are definitely getting ready.
Yeah. And have things materially improved, do you think?
I definitely think so. So I know for a fact that as I've been working with some of the states, well, I guess a few little anecdotes come to mind. One is that there are people who are calling up asking me for advice on a variety of things, and firewalls and things like that. And I say, well, okay, let's focus on the basics. And they say, oh, I forgot to mention, we already have 2FA turned down. We already have password managers. We already have our systems patched. Like, oh, really? And what state are you in? Because that's kind of interesting. So we've been getting some of that feedback as well. So I feel like there is a sense of urgency in various places. Of course, I'm not talking to literally every state and every party chair and every campaign, but I am getting some telemetry back that there are people who are taking things seriously. A few places have modified the checklist to include other things. Fantastic. Take it, change it, throw half of it out. but please just start to get rigorous about what you actually think you need to do and then start to measure your progress. And so we're starting to see that, and I'm hoping that that will continue between now and not just the election, but between now and 2020.
Do you have any contact with, I'm assuming you have a counterpart at the GOP. I would have thought it would make sense for you two to connect, or is that relationship, that adversarial mindset between the two parties just too extreme to allow that sort of friendliness?
Yeah, I don't know if it's too extreme. Right now, I've had so much interesting work just getting my feet wet and trying to understand what I have to do within that first zone, which is the DNC, and then, of course, all the state parties. I feel like between us and the various consultants that we have and other people who are assisting us, I feel like we have most of the right pieces. Of course, if they want to give me a call, I'm on Twitter, send me a DM and we'll go grab lunch.
Because I just would have thought, like, we're seeing this, are you seeing that? That that would have been, that's a relationship you might want to have because you two are facing the same threats, right?
Yeah, I guess to some degree, but...
although those threats seem to be asymmetrically applied at the moment, right?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to say it. Until further notice, I may have the lion's share of the issues.
I can't finish this interview without asking you an incredibly stupid question. But, Trump is always banging on about handing over the server. Where did the servers go? Now, first of all, I'd imagine that this was a, multi-endpoint intrusion that occurred in 2016. And I presume you've got access to the full CrowdStrike report, not just the part that they made public. So I'm guessing there were multiple intrusions. They would have imaged the boxes, done their analysis and then passed that along to the FBI. So the actual physical server doesn't seem that important. And I'd also imagine that if you're a political party, you might not want to give your entire mail server to the FBI. That's reasonable. But do you have a succinct way to actually bat that away? And I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So like I said, these questions are just such silly distractions. I will send you the actual quote that we've published so that you can put that into the notes. These are things that are just distractions from the real issue, which is that we had a Foreign Intelligence Service break in here. And I love the people who actually do forensics for a living saying, like, this is just preposterous. They don't touch physical servers. Here's how we do our job. Here's how we establish chain of custody. Here's how we know that we have the right data. And, to all of those people
was there a full chain of custody for all of that information from CrowdStrike off to the FBI?
The people who did this analysis are the best people around. This was a well-done operation. So I have full faith that we've done everything that we need to do. But the reality is people bringing these things up, these are techniques that they use to get the spotlight of your attention away from the actual problems, which is that we have foreign
fake
government.
Fake news, Bob. Where did you put the server? Where did you put it?
Yes. it's around here somewhere. I'll find it. It's just so ridiculous. And, and I also object when people start talking about the word meddling. Meddling is like, somebody else had a great tweet about this. Meddling was something like, that's what my mother-in-law does when I come home late at night. Or something, she meddles in my affairs. That's not what this is. This was sabotage. And that's the conversation that we need to have. And unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, we're just not having that conversation. So,
well, I think it's a part of that, to be honest, is because the word interference actually has some pretty significant legal meaning in international law, right? Interference is a specific thing, and the threshold for reaching that is quite high. So it just seems like the media have settled on meddling, and sabotage does seem a bit loaded. So I'm going to defend my colleagues in the media on that one, Bob.
Okay, all
right. We got here for a reason. Sabotage. That's good though. I can see why you want to push that. Bob Lord, what have I missed? What have I not covered here? Do you think this has been a pretty comprehensive discussion? I mean, what is something that we haven't talked about that you think is quite important to get out there?
So I don't know if it's important, but I'll mention a couple of cute things, or at least one. It's interesting how many people really care. I started getting these text messages or these DMs from this guy. I didn't know this guy. And it turns out he's this 18-year-old guy in the Netherlands. And he pointed out a few things, which I knew, but I appreciated him providing me some additional perspective. And And I started digging in, like, who is this guy that keeps sending me all of these DMs about these security related things? And it turns out that he just wanted to help. He saw some of his friends just being critical of the DNC and the security posture here. And he said, you know what, you can complain and wag your finger, but you should just do something about it. So he decided to do something about it. And
a bit of an unauthorized bug bounty.
We're not quite at the bug bounty stage yet, but you know, I'm happy to listen to people who have good points of view and who have expertise in various areas. And he had an expertise in a certain area, and he, by gum, he was right. And so, you know, we'll remember when we actually get the bug bounty program stood up. So that's one thing. The other thing I would be remiss in not mentioning is, like, we're hiring. And so we have different recs open for everything from an IT director who, by the way, should really have a lot of security experience. I'm going to have a very strong bias for security for the IT director, as well as things like application security and incident response. So we're going to be staffing up, and we're going to be making sure that we're ready for not just a two-year election cycle, four-year presidential cycle, but we're actually building a foundation that we can be proud of, you know, year after year.
All right. Okay, well, Bob Lord, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's been a fascinating chat, and we wish you the best of luck in your endeavors.
Hey, Patrick, it's been a real pleasure, and you know I'm a longtime fan of yours.
That was Bob Lord of the DNC there. I do hope you enjoyed that. I'll be back in a few days with a Snake Oilers edition of the show, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Thank you.